House Civil Law Committee will come to order. We don't have any minutes to approve. We already did it. We're not approving any minutes. And members, the purpose of this committee is to clear up, to have discussions about some of the unfinished business from last session so that Chair Scott can hit the ground running starting in January. But as such, we've completed the minutes from the last meeting, and also nothing that we decide on here today will be procedurally moved on to any floor or any other committee since the new legislature takes office in January, January 6th. So with that, the first item of business is discussion of the status of the Department of Human Services study on impact of data practices. The one-year exemption for health plans granted in the Timberjay bill, which was Senate File 1770. And the first testifier I have today is Mark Amphenson with the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Mr. Amphenson, please come forward and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Amphenson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association and many other news organizations in the state. I really don't have any specific prepared testimony for the committee today, other than to tell you that I was intimately involved in the Timberjay bill from its genesis. It was a bill that was a product of a Supreme Court case I had litigated. The Supreme Court adopted a rather tortured interpretation of state statute that had been in place for 15 years and surprised a lot of people with how it saw the law operating, which caused a good deal of distress both among news organizations and many other people who use this part of the Data Practices Act, which is 13.05 subdivision 11, the privatization section, as it's called. And so the Newspaper Association crafted for introduction in the 2014 session what we saw as a simple corrective bill. And of course, as all of you know, such simple bills tend to evolve sometimes in strange ways. And if ever that were true, it was the case with this bill. So if the bill in its original form had gone through and been enacted, it would simply have restored state law, the interpretation of state law, 13.05 subdivision 11, to the way in which it had been construed both by the appellate court and by the Information Policy Analysis Division of IPAD since 1999. But along the path to enactment, something very complicated happened, and that is the state's health plans, which, as you all know, are major contractors with the state, receive a very large percentage of state funding to then use to conduct their mission of health care. The health plans got very uneasy about the impact on their operations of the so-called Timberjay bill. They felt specifically that requiring a lot of the data they obtained from their subcontractors, their medical providers, requiring public access to those when it came into the health plan's hands was untenable. And that led to some of the most stimulating negotiations I have ever participated in the legislature over many weeks. And the result is Chapter 293 of the statutes, which basically the Solomonic solution that was achieved was to give the health plans an exemption for a year from the bill so that it could be studied. The issue could be studied. And I support broad public access. I think much of what the health plans obtain from their subcontractors in terms of data should be public because they are paying for most of that with taxpayer money. Having said that, I concede and came to learn that the complexities of the kind of data they obtain, these health plans obtain from their medical providers, doesn't lend itself to simplistic generalizations. And I will say that very candidly. So, one-year study was to be done by DHS. I know nothing about how that's come out, but the rest of the Timber J bill has been working fine since it was enacted in May and applies to all other government contractors in the state as it was intended to do and as the 1999 legislature intended for this statute to operate. And again, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to meander on here. If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer them, but that I'm just sort of setting the table for the broader question that the committee is going to be looking at.
Thank you, Mr. Amphinson, and that's that was what we're looking for is kind of the background of how this all occurred and how all of a sudden this study ended up being a part of it. Are there questions for Mr. Amphinson? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, just to be really clear, in your view, did the law previously require the, let me say it differently, did the law previously put the health plan data in the same bucket with everybody else's data, or was there previously some exemption for the health plans?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, that's an interesting question. And the law, to answer it very literally, the answer is the law put their data that they collected from their subcontractors in exactly the same bucket. The oddity that emerged in the discussions, however, was that the DHS had entered into contracts with the health plans that, in effect, and in my judgment, improperly exempted them from part of the Data Practices Act, which, I don't think DHS had the authority to essentially override state law and say that the health plans, by contract, did not have to comply. But that's what it was, and again, what happened is no one apparently requested this data from the health plans under this provision. They could have. I'm surprised no one did, but evidently no one did. And so the issue never was really confronted until we entered into these negotiations last spring on the bill.
Any other questions for Mr. Amphinson? Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Amphinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Next testifier on the list is Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services. Oh, and Patrick Haltman is testifying as well, Legislative Budget and Fiscal Policy Manager for the Department of Human Services. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. And
Patrick Haltman with the department.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just provide a couple real brief notes about the status of the report and then happy to answer any questions that you might have. So since the time of the passage of the legislation, we've conducted discussions internally within DHS, within other agencies, specifically Department of Health, Department of Commerce, and other state agencies, and in some interested stakeholders, and was really experiencing, I think, some of the same conversations that were occurring at the legislative table here, much of which is conflicting information about the likely impact or result of this type of information becoming public data. So as such, we have decided to issue a request for information so that we can gather even more information from those interested in providing that information, could be citizens, could be those parties affected by specifically by the passage of this legislation. And so that RFI is actually published as of today. The due date on that will be January 12th. The intent is that we need to hear from more folks about their perspective on the transparency and the likely impact that this might have. And we are also working with a health economist as an external resource to provide some additional information for us. So, Mr. Chair, again, that's just the technical aspect of where we're at with the process, and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. Any questions for Mr. Morocco? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, did you say, I was just taking notes and couldn't quite keep up with your speaking. Did you say that you put out a request for information, and did you say that you do have that data available now? Or
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Ms. Morocco.
Mr. Chair, so the RFI is actually issued today. The end date will be January 12th.
Okay, I did not.
And we have full intention of publishing everything that we receive through the RFI. So certainly we'll use it as a tool for developing the report, but we will provide all of the responses unfiltered for those that might be interested in the totality of the information.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you just put that out, help me understand a request for information. Did you put that out to the general public, or did you send specific notifications to the stakeholders in this case?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, that will be for anyone who wishes to respond to it. So it's published on the general registry, and anyone that wants to respond can do so.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, why did it take so long to get this, to put out an RFI? I mean, you know, I don't know what the effective date was of the legislation, but you certainly knew about it the minute we passed it.
Mr. Morocco, actually, before you ask that question, because I'm not sure if I'm clear, I'll ask this. Mr. Morocco, if the RFI went out today and the information is supposed to come in by January, how do you intend to comply with state law that says that we have to have this report by December 21st?
Mr. Chair, we certainly recognize that we will be unable to meet that deadline. We would fully anticipate it being available, you know, early within the session. Both to your question, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Liebling, I'm not sure that we expected the kind of complexities to come out of our internal process, again, working with stakeholders and working with other state agencies. We just simply were not able to, through those resources, to achieve the kind of outcome or the ability to produce the report that we felt was being asked of us from the legislature. So, you know, certainly, you know, there was no specific resources allocated as part of this report. And so we had looked at many different options, either outsourcing it completely, looking to other entities within the state that perhaps we could try to assist us with this. Where we've landed today with the RFI and with some external resources is ultimately where we felt we could strike the right balance between getting enough information and being able to produce a report that either addresses specifically the questions that you're asking, or to the extent that they can't be answered, to at least point out where the legislature can provide the kind of clarity that we're looking for. And so Representative Liebling, no disrespect to the deadline itself, but we felt it was more important to take this corrective course and go down the route of the RFI.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Morocco, I'm really disappointed, I guess would be one way to say, you know, because first of all, we're starting in this whole down this whole issue because the department over many years has basically disregarded state law. We just heard that from Mr. Anfinson. And for you to say we thought it was better to disregard the deadline, which is in state law, to give you what we thought we should give you is really disappointing, because you're basically saying we don't care what the law says, we're going to do what we're going to do. And that is not something that lawmakers really like to hear a lot. So there's that. I would really like to ask you to give us a little more flavor of this. What I'm hearing is this is so complicated. We opened this hornet's nest, and now we've got to figure out how to chase down all the hornets. I'd like to know a little more about what is this great complexity that nobody anticipated that suddenly we all know is there, because Well, I'd just like to hear the answer to that question.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think some examples might be what is considered public data and non-public data. Oftentimes, if you do a review of the information, it's based on specific context of the information being asked and under what conditions it's being asked. And so as we've consulted specifically with IPAD, oftentimes you have to evaluate what the economic value of the releasing of that data might be in order to determine whether or not it's trade secret versus not trade secret. So, you know, that's an example of where we didn't expect there to be as much ambiguity when we started this process as it has now turned out that there is more uncertainty in that area, and I think that's where we need more time and more information from the general public and from other state agencies to help us sort that out. And you know, Patrick might be able to provide you some more specifics there. He certainly has been engaged as well with some of the stakeholders. I don't know if you'd have anything you want to add. Or
Mr. Oldman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just that this is the complexity of sort of data practices along with healthcare economics, and I think our thinking along these lines is just we want to provide the best answer that we possibly can because of the importance of the issue to the legislature. We regret that we weren't able to complete it on a more aggressive timeline, but I think the seriousness and the gravity of the question, we hope that it'll be worth the information will be worth the wait.
Yeah, and I think Mr. Chair, to add to that, and again, our apologies to the committee and to Representative Liebling, because we do recognize the importance of this. I think when we had started, we had thought that this was going to be really a focus on what is the economic outcome of this kind of transparency, and what we ended up with was as much ambiguity around what is and is not public data as much as what would the likely impact be of the releasing of that information. And that was really one of the confounding factors in us having to take more time and be more thorough with the report, because we believe that was the intent of the legislative ask on the impact of this data.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Morocco, did you consult with either the chair of this committee or the authors of the legislation
about
this necessary delay?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm going to ask Patrick to respond to that. I know that we have been in touch with some legislators, but specifically.
Mr. Altman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've spoken to staff with Senator Lori's office and let him know that it looks like we're going to be a little bit late with this report, and we have a memo drafted with a new effective date. Just needs to get the approval of our commissioner.
I'm sorry. Would you repeat that? You have a proposal for what kind of date, Mr. Altman?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I misspoke. I didn't mean effective date. Obviously, that's the date we're missing. The date on which we anticipate being complete with the report.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you could give your reaction to Mr. Anfinson's statement that DHS improperly exempted health plans from the Data Practices Act. Just wondering if you have a response to that.
Mr. Morocco.
Statement.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I don't have a response on that at this time, but I would certainly be happy to talk to our contracting folks.
So you're saying, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that that you don't agree or disagree either way with him. He's saying the DHS, took this action and improperly exempted the health plans, and you're not going to say one way or the other whether you agree with that.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, that is true, but simply because I'm not involved in that part of the process. I do know that we made some changes to the contracts for 2015. I'd be happy to provide to you, Representative Scott, and to the committee the specifics of both answering your question as well as outlining the changes that we made that may have addressed that.
One second, Representative Scott. Mr. Morocco, who in your department is the go-to person for that function?
Mr. Chair, there's actually several folks that negotiate the contracts. There's actually three separate contracts, which divides up the various portions of our population, and it's a team of folks that negotiate that. Today, ultimately, that reports up through our Medicaid director, but prior to that, because there was a vacancy there, it was a team of folks that were actually responsible for the contracting process itself, but they do all ultimately report to me.
Okay, so, oh, well, Mr. Morocco, this committee needs to know who we send a letter to say, hey, come on in and respond. Is this true or not true? So are you the right person, or is there someone else we should be sending a letter to in the park?
Mr. Chair, you can address that letter to me, and I will bring or assign the appropriate folks to answer any questions that you may have. What I would like to suggest as a starting point is to address this question specifically that Representative Scott has brought forward, and if that doesn't answer the question to your satisfaction, we'd be more than happy to either meet with this committee or meet with individuals to address that question.
Okay, well, I know, Representative Scott, you don't know the question, and I am definitely interested, and I imagine you're proposing to respond in writing, which is fine, but just so you know, I'm a lawyer too, and sometimes I write things and people have questions about it after I write them, so there may be questions and follow-up. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Mr. Holtman, are you an attorney?
Mr. Chair, member, no, I'm not.
Oh, okay, thank you. My other question is, what did anyone ask the PLAL plans in the past what they were basing their, which piece of statute or which part of the data practices statute they were basing their current classification upon? Did anyone ask them that? And if so, what did they say?
Mr. Holtman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, the relevant section of statute is 256B.69, subdivision 9A and C.
And I don't have that memorized, if I might, Mr. Chair. If you could just share that with the body or the folks here, what that says in essence.
Mr. Holtman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it prohibits the department from releasing certain data that the plans send us in relation to their contract with us, mostly individual level data. I think there's some information about plan financials. There's a couple other things. Anything that we get from them that's in that subdivision, I don't have it in front of me. But
thank you, Representative Scott. Well, maybe I can recollect your thoughts, Representative Scott. let me ask this: were either of you at a committee hearing that we had, a joint committee hearing of civil law? HHS policy and finance on April 28th.
No, I Mr. Chair, we had folks from the department that were present. We weren't there, though.
Is there any of the folks from the department who were there at that meeting? And maybe I can refresh your memory. This was a meeting that had occurred after a quote-unquote compromise was crafted on the floor, and it was a short notice hearing of civil law, HHS policy and HHS finance, and it went on for 4 hours to discuss this very issue. Do you recall that, or was there someone in the audience from your department who was there?
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of the meeting that you're referring to, the four-hour meeting, yes.
Okay. But so is your answer is that there's no one here who was there on that day, is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I don't believe so.
Well, the reason I'm asking that, Mr. Holtman, is because what you're just stating, this statute, 256B, 69, subdivision 9AC, I mean, that was 7 months ago, 8 months ago? I can't do the math. But it was a long time ago, and this is the first time I've heard of that particular provision. I don't recall it being brought up then. I'm kind of wondering why this is the first time I've heard about that. And furthermore, what were the key issues that really stymied your department from making any progress. I'm assuming that an RFI probably would normally have occurred relatively soon after we crafted that compromise, if not after when it was this bill was presented to the governor on May 17th and signed on the 28th. Were there any major issues that were hurdles for you starting this sooner?
Mr. Chair, we had difficulty finding a healthcare economist that would actually support us in this project, and we felt like that was the most critical question. That was what led to the compromise to begin with. Was a concern about disruption of the healthcare market, and it took some time to actually acquire that resource.
Okay, Representative Scott, are you ready for your question now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Okay, so Mr. Gehring was kind enough to turn me to the statute that you cited. And it really doesn't have anything to do with classifying the data. It talks about the data, but doesn't really classify how that data is, or it doesn't really say how that data should be classified. So I'm going to try again here. The health plan data, how have you classified it in the past? Or have you not classified it at all?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, again, as I alluded to earlier on, it depends on the context under which the data request is being made. So when we get into issues like trade secret, as an example, we would have to evaluate the economic impact of the releasing of that data. If there is an economic impact, then it could be potentially treated as trade secret and therefore not public. There are obviously other components that are specifically outlined by the legislature that designate what is public and non-public. So it is within that grayness where, it would depend on the request and the specifics of the request. And that, again, to the prior question about the delay, it was the expansion of that question that I think for us necessitated this going down this route, because, again, we were not only addressing what is the economic impact of releasing data, but then also specifically to this question, what is and is not public data, and that's where it became quite complicated for us to resolve.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've never had in the past any requests for this data where you've turned a person down because you've said that it was trade secret information? Have you ever had that instance? I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I have not personally, but I have been with the department for a better part of a year now. I would be happy to go back to the group and see if we've had specific requests and to follow up on that piece as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who for DHS is their reporting authority? Who do they go to if there's – who in your department is the go-to person when someone in the public has a data request?
Mr.
Chair and Representative Scott, we do have a legal office that does review those kinds of data requests. Is there a name? Or?
I think just give the question.
Again, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, if you want to direct that to me, I will ensure that it gets to the right resource within DHS.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair, thank you, but doesn't it set out in statute that each agency has to have a head person has the authority to handle all the data requests? And are you telling me you don't know specifically who that person is or persons? It's just the legal department in general, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it's Amy Akbay is the head of our legal management office, and yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott, are there any other questions for Representative Liebling?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Morocco, you're aware that the state also does a lot of its health care through county-based purchasing organizations, correct?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, yes.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, the county-based purchasing organizations, are they also trying to claim that they have proprietary information that they don't want released, or are they already pretty much releasing information about their payments to providers? I mean, I think that's mainly what we're talking about here, is payments to providers, And it's my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the county-based organizations already have, that's already public information as to them. Am I correct?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm not sure that I can answer specifically for the county-based purchasing, but to your point, there are multiple entities or ways that payments are made on behalf of the DHS program. So we do have the fee-for-service program. We have what occurs through the managed care organizations. We have another group we would refer to as the integrated health partnerships, which are, in essence, sort of quasi-direct contracting between DHS and providers, but we do use the MCOs as sort of a pass-through. But I can't, I don't know the answer specifically to the county-based purchasing. That would be a question you would have to raise to them. But we would hope that they would be one of the responders to the RFI and to bring, you know, whatever questions or concerns that they may have forward to us.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we might have a representative in the room who could speak to this because, and Mr. Chair, I know you have other things you want to move on to here, but I think it's really important to dig into this a little bit, and this whole question about keeping this information proprietary. I mean, obviously, under the law, this is they're going to lose their exemption, even if DHS never does fulfill its part of the statute here. That exemption is separate from their coming forward with the information. So it seems to me that in a very real sense, the burden is on the plans to come and show that they need the continuing exemption. And I think that we have the county-based plans that are pretty much operating the way I think the other managed care plans could be operating, and that is with openness as to a lot of this. So just to be a little clear, what Mr. Morocco's described, or what both these gentlemen have described about how complex this is and how many issues there are, and I think that I may be wrong, but I think county-based purchasing has kind of already modeled how this isn't all that difficult because they've already made these distinctions. So it would be great if we could hear from them if they're willing.
Well, Representative Liebling, I just want to respond to you and start by saying this whole thing stinks. I am concerned. I am confused by multiple things. I am confused by the delay that violates state law on this. I am confused by the nature of how things went suddenly at the end of last session, where this exemption was shoehorned in at the last minute. I am confused at how all of a sudden someone in the health plans decided this is a major issue at the beginning of last session. And I'm confused about the argument of how either it applied or it didn't apply previous to the court decision in November and after the court decision in November. And I don't get it. It's possible that someone could explain it to me and me get it. But after a year of looking at this, I still don't. And testifier after testifier, it's not making it clearer to me. On the contrary, it's making it muddier. So with that, thank you for your testimony. If there are no other questions, we appreciate you being here today in the hot seat. And there are other folks who want to testify this. I know folks in the audience. Can I just see show of hands, who in the audience wants to be heard on this? One, two, three. Okay, we have roughly three, four. Okay, why don't you please come down. Rich, Ms. Neumeister, why don't you start out. Introduce yourself for the record, and please keep your comments brief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Civil Law Committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. To me, it's very simple, very clear what the situation was. After the law took effect, I immediately started speaking with the Department of Human Services. I talk about it in social media, on blogs, and things like that I've done constantly. And I got a response, nothing, or something will happen, or whatever. Even to the point to where I went to Senator Lori and sort of said, and this was pretty much in September, he says, hey, when are they going to get their act together, the department, so that you, the legislature, gets a quality, well-balanced, with all people's interest report to share with you? Because, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, being around a long time, I know those reports that are all of a sudden miraculously written in December don't give you the quality that you ask for. So there is the way that you're going to ask those kinds of questions, why and how come, I think are very important ones, no matter who's in power, Republicans or Democrats. So I applaud you on doing those kinds of things. In terms of what in 2015 should be the answer and how you go by and where you're coming into this, I look at it as that the plans want to have as much as they can be secret. And one of the things about that is that just by me talking to a number, an array of people, and in other situations, they might want the contract that's from, let's say, Blue Health, Blue Shield, or any of the plans to a particular doctor or HMO plan, maybe the whole contract to be trade secret. Those are issues that I have dealt with for the last 15 months with government agencies and a number of data requests. And then what happens after you fight them, you do get the contract, except maybe certain kinds of information should be not public. So if the plans have their wish, they would like to have a broad exemption. And the thing that you need to do, and hopefully this report may do to help guide you, is to be specific with specific things. For example, and Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling talked about this, there are already similar things like that on the public, you know, with the county. Even with Medicare, as one may know, in the last 8 months, 9 months, the national level is now saying, this is where Johnny Jones' optometrist is getting $647,000 of Medicare money. Now, I see no problem with why we, the public, should know where the $3 billion of public monies are going into managed care. Same concept. And so we can sort of see where patterns are or if they're relationships, but also where we can see the quality. So the thing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think it's pretty simple. The issue is that there is interest of DHS and HMOs that are sort of mingled, and I don't know which is which, because one is supposed to be an overseer, one is not. One is maybe is overseeing the other. I don't know. Those are other issues, and there have been allegations about that publicly over the last several years. But I think that when you come into 2015, you know, just ask, what do you want to be secret? What do you want to be exempt? And them to be specific. And then when you hear that, then you'll hear some folks on the other side. And that's then where you sort of like, okay. And that's why the Data Practices Act allows you, the legislature, to be specific rather than these broad exemptions. And that's why it's tough, because in many other states and on the federal level, they have these broad things. And then for the public and even the policymakers, it's rough to get information. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the civil law, that's just my just general overview and perspective as we all come again to the Capitol in 2015.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Groats. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. And I would just state this before your testimony, Mr. Groats. Mr. Neumeister threw out the number of $3 billion a year. I've been told $8 billion. I've been told $9 billion. I've been told $5 billion. And if you testify subsequently on this, I'd be curious, how much public money is flowing through these contracts annually, and can you break down, is this federal and state or what have you? So, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Groats.
My name is Jim Groats, and I'm from Edina, Minnesota. To answer your question specifically on the number, I recall so vividly the testimony of Representative Liebling before the floor, which was picked up and used on KSTP Channel 5, $8 billion. That's just stuck since I've seen that and heard that. That is just stuck in my mind. In terms of breaking that down, I'm not in a position to do that. I wanted to speak to members of the committee and tell you, you come to this with preconceived notions in terms of who's doing their job, who's doing what. It's pretty clear to me that DHS isn't doing their job, but I wanted to tell you also, there is so very little oversight on these HMOs, and I want to give you some specific examples. Go up to the Attorney General's office, to the Charities Division, and ask for the file on Health Partners. There is none. And the reason for it is that Health Partners is a 501c4, And even though most of these health plans are 501c4s, they don't even have a file on them. Go ahead and ask for the file on UCARE, and you will find copies of their tax returns in there, very little information. Once a year, the Attorney General sends out a questionnaire asking certain questions be asked in return, so on and so forth. Pay your fee. It's just a paper shuffling checkoff. Then start asking your questions. Since these entities were created by the Internal Revenue Service, surely there are people here in this state carefully looking at these entities, these health plans. The answer is no. And I had a long conversation with a person involved with criminal investigations of the Internal Revenue Service, and I was told, well, you see, Mr. Groats, these are tax-exempt organizations. We don't have any oversight in Minnesota. I said, well, what about Chicago or Kansas City or St. Louis? No, I'm sorry, Mr. Groats, there is no oversight for these HMOs in these areas. Finally, after digging around, I found out the nearest oversight office is Ohio. We don't have anybody looking at these plans. As I was told when I started looking at the state archives, well, we assume everyone is honest. I've spent a lot of time looking at documents and going through things, and it's shocking what there is. And now the HMOs want to come here, even though there's virtually no eyes on their financial statements and everything else. And looking at the long-term trends is what you have to do. You can't look at a year-to-year comparison. Let's look at the 10-year numbers. Let's take a look at the asset growth over 10 years. There is no need for additional rate increases. There really isn't. And as you look at this even deeper, you find obvious admissions of problems on the financial statements. Well, the trouble is, if no one is reading them, how can we go after them? So here we are. They're asking for trade secrets. They're already virtually, there's very few eyes looking at anything. Now we're asking to have everything covered by trade secrets. Really what this is a game of pretend. They're all pretending that, well, here's what we're paying, here's what it cost, here's what we're reimbursing our providers with. But when you go out and you start talking to the providers, you're going to find, well, if it were this great, why are we having difficulties? Why is it those in rural Minnesota are having difficulty making ends meet? I wanted to call these facts to your attention because you're all presuming that there's many, many eyes looking at these HMOs, when in fact, there's virtually nobody watching. And I'm here to state that I'm not in favor of any extension of trade secrets, and it's just high time. We also have audits of these plans. We're one of the few states, no audits. We have to have audits. We have to know where this $8 billion that Representative Liebling pleaded for at the close of the session, where is it going? We as taxpayers are entitled to know, and we are entitled to have these people held accountable. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Groats. Matt Ayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We've previously testified on this issue when we've supplied you with a sort of a detailed packet if you want to look into it in more length. The thing I want to draw attention to right now is if you look in the back of our packet, there is a proposed amendment to the House version of the Timber Jay bill that was circulated in this room at the April Joint Health and Human Services Committee hearing. There's no information about where it came from, but it was circulated as part of the materials. And I would suggest that this might provide a specific question or an answer to the specific question about what data is at issue here for the plans. And this, I would suggest, should be where the legislature should look to try to wrap their arms around this issue. If you look at the last page of the proposed amendment, you'll see that in line 2.24, this is an amendment to 256B.69, which regulates how the health care plans manage the public health care, or excuse me, how the health plans manage the public health care programs in part. It specifies that data provided to the commissioner under this subdivision are non-public data as defined under Section 13.02 of the Data Practices Act. And the data that's being referred to are administrative spending expenses. So traditionally, and this is an old piece of statute, that data has been not public data when it's sitting at DHS or sitting at Health, which I believe collects part of this data. Then you'll see in the underlined portion starting at 2.25, the proposed language, and it reads in its entirety, data related to contracted amounts paid to providers and vendors for administrative services by managed care organizations in state public health care programs are non-public data as defined in Section 13.02. So if you see in the existing language, that protects data that's at the agency. Apparently, someone believes that data elsewhere needs protection as well, and the other place this data exists is at the health plans. So I would warrant that the plans see it either under 1305 sub 11 or under 1346, the welfare section of the Data Practices Act, a mechanism for making public requests to get that kind of data. And that data really is the key question to, I think, the puzzle. The amounts paid to providers and the administrative expenses, if you know what those are, and you subtract those from what we know are the public capitated block payments that are provided to the healthcare plans, then you understand what it costs the plans to run the programs, because you know what they're paying out and you know what they're retaining. And I think if the legislature doesn't have access to that kind of information, we really would suggest that that should be public, and the public itself needs to know what those costs are. So I wanted to simply call that out, because I think that provides the key piece of information about further regulation in this matter. I'd be happy to take any questions.
First of all, Mr. Ealing, thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Mr. Ealing, since about April of last year, this is the first time that I've heard any plan or proposal of which information to keep secret. And it didn't come from a health plan. It came from an open government advocate. Now, as it stands, all of this information will be public in the middle of next year. So while I appreciate your proposal and you put work into it, I, as a legislator who makes $31,000 a year as a legislator, am not interested in doing the work of a health plan CEO that makes a couple million a year. I'm waiting for them to spend some of their millions to come up with a plan that would be viable. But if they don't, I'm okay with that too, because it becomes public by law next year. So with all due respect, I really wanted to focus this hearing on the report that was going to come from DHS. Maybe after my remarks, one of the health plans could hire you as a consultant, because I haven't heard from any others. But Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment. Thank you very much for your testimony. But just for anybody who may be listening who may not understand this, the legislators do not have access to anything that the public doesn't also have access to. So unlike Congress, where sometimes people have some kind of security clearance or something, where they in fact are getting information that other mortals don't get, we don't have that here. So if you can't know it, neither can we. Just want to make that really clear to everyone.
Other questions for Mr. Ealing? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Ealing.
Thank you.
David Feinwachs.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dave Feinwachs. I'm a resident of St. Paul. I have an interest in these issues and have followed them for some years. Let me first, Mr. Chair, refer to something you said. You said earlier that this stinks. If I may add my own view, this stinks on ICE. The legislature has been deprived of information for many, many years. We have not been able to obtain, as citizens, nor you as legislators, access to anything about where these tax funds go, how they're allocated, what's used for administration, what's not. The circumstance has become untenable. Recently, after the work of this legislature last year, our Department of Human Services has been asked to answer what I would argue is a relatively straightforward question. Explain to us why this secrecy should continue. Apparently, that takes more time than was allocated. There are a variety of ambiguities in this situation which need to be addressed, and I appreciate the fact, having talked to many of you, how big a commitment it is for people not involved in the Health and Human Services area to try to understand the complexity of what's going on and what's involved in wading into this. And on behalf of myself and others, let me simply say thank you for undertaking it, because this is some tough stuff. Having said that, let me illustrate for you some of the ambiguities. Our Department of Human Services has contracts with our health plan vendors that says that DHS has access to all the types of data that we're talking about. DHS has never asked for any of it. Mr. Anfinson, who is recognized by many people, including me, especially me, as a source authority about these areas of the law, is absolutely correct in his statement. My limited understanding of the law here is that people claim trade secret protection, but DHS has to grant it to them. No health plan has actually ever been granted trade secret protection by DHS. In fact, one of the other anomalies in the contracts is there's a provision that seems to indicate that we will only apply the data practices law to the minimum extent we can get away with. I mean, literally, that's what it says to the health plans. Why would the regulatory agency charged with oversight of this have those kinds of provisions? The way these programs are being administered is a complete mystery. Now, one of the problems you face and one of the problems we face is a rotating cast of characters. People who were here 4 months ago are no longer here. People who are here today cannot properly provide response because they weren't here 4 months ago or even a year ago. There is a gentleman named Buddy Robinson, who some of you know, from the Greater Minnesota Healthcare Coalition, who has been corresponding and meeting with DHS staff, including, I think, Mr. Haltman. And he has received a letter, and I will be happy to provide you with copies of this, where DHS acknowledges that they lack claims and encounter data necessary to set Medicaid rates. If that's true, the first level of inquiry is, who's setting the Medicaid rates for the state? And how do we know that they have any basis in reality? Given that these questions are out there, and given by the fact that there are inquiries about what the expense of the program is, because there's nothing humorous about that inquiry, too. Nobody's actually really sure. We're not really sure how much the feds contribute at any given time and how much they're funding. All of these things need to be at some base level minimally understood, and given the amount of ambiguity, given the uncertainty, and given the lack of understanding, the argument that somehow continued secrecy is desirable is difficult for me to comprehend, and I'm certainly hoping it will be impossible for you to comprehend. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwachs. Are there questions for Mr. Feinwachs? Mr. Feinwachs, I have a question. Excuse me. But before I do, Representative Liebling, based on your statement on the House floor that we're talking about $8 billion a year in public money, what percentage of the state budget is that? Do you know?
Well, Mr. Chair, usually we think about the HHS budget in its entirety as being about, I think it's the second largest budget that we have in the state. I think I might be really, I can't really answer that right now off the top of my head, but I don't know for that number, but let me just explain if I could where I got that number, because it is difficult to know what the number really is. And before we went on the House floor to have that discussion, I knew I wanted to talk about this. I went to my staff and I said, give me the number. I need to know the number of our spending, because frankly, it's a number that I never have really had my arms around either. And that was a number they gave me, not without some difficulty to find it. So if people want to know exactly what that number represents, I'm afraid I couldn't tell you, but it was the best my staff could come up with at the time so that I could at least have a number to use. But whether that what's in that number, I just couldn't say. So Mr. Feinwachs is absolutely correct in that.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Liebling. And the reason I asked is whether we're talking 20%, 25%, or 30% of the state budget, that's a large number. And my question relates to the ability to audit that. And Mr. Feinwachs, you had explained in another hearing of your understanding of the statement from the HMOs that these numbers could not be audited because they did not use generally accepted accounting principles. And I was surprised to hear that, and I wondered, is there any other equivalent in state government where we tell the taxpayers, we're spending your money, but sorry, we can't do an audit? Are you aware of any other instances of that?
Mr. Chairman, members, no. The HMOs and in the insurance industry uses NAIC, which stands for National Association of Insurance Commissioners, accounting systems. This is unique to them. Nobody else uses it. The rest of the world, the entire rest of the world, uses GAAP, or generally accepted accounting principles. And so no one else does this. We have no knowledge of how any of this might work or how it changes from day to day. And we also know, and as I provided information to previous hearing, we now know based on the correspondence of July 2012 that our Department of Commerce doesn't audit this either. So if Commerce doesn't audit it, and if DHS doesn't have data sufficient to set a rate, it's pretty clear that this is an unaudited, self-reported activity, and that is untenable.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwachs. Is there anyone else from the audience here who wishes to offer testimony to the committee on this at this time? Seeing none, any other comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, then I personally, Representative Scott, am looking forward to reading that letter from Mr. Morocco to you, so I'd love to get a copy as soon as you get one. Thank you. Thank you to all the testifiers. Moving on to number three in the agenda, discussion of license plate readers by use of law enforcement. The first testifier we have on the agenda is Stacy Christensen from iPad. Welcome to the committee again, Ms. Christensen. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Stacy Christensen. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division in the Department of Administration. And I'm just going to provide a very brief overview of both the temporary classification process and the temporary classification that's currently in effect for the automatic license plate reader data. I thought I would just provide a brief overview about the process, just to provide some clarity to how we got to where we are and what it all entails. So the Commissioner of Administration has authority to issue, and I'm also going to explain what the temporary classification does and what it doesn't do. So the Commissioner of Administration has authority to issue temporary classifications on data that are requested by government entities. There are certain situations where the commissioner can determine that a particular classification needs to have statewide effect. And in certain situations, if that is the case for statewide effect, the classification is in effect for 90 days until the commissioner approves or disapproves the application. Then the attorney general weighs in on form and legality and has to approve it for those situations. A temporary classification does not reclassify data, so the data has to actually be public, presumptively public, for the commissioner to issue a temporary classification, so there wouldn't ever be a change in a classification. The temporary classification also doesn't address issues of retention, so it just will classify data. The way that retention works in Minnesota is each government entity sets a retention schedule that goes through an approval process, and they make those determinations, and that's how long the data are retained. So the legislature is certainly able to kind of weigh in on those retention issues, but the temporary classification process won't address it. So for the one at issue with the automatic license plate reader data, this was a request that came in from the city of Minneapolis, and the commissioner determined because of the data and how it affected all similar government entities, it would have statewide impact and therefore had the 90-day time frame. Then once a temporary classification is, if it is approved, it has to be submitted to the legislature the year after it's approved and then expires the year following. So in this situation, this temporary classification expires August 1st, 2015. So this coming summer it will expire. And this classification was a little bit unique because in the classification, and I will go through the data elements that were and were not classified, but some of the data that were requested to have a temporary classification were already classified by law. So the commissioner did not approve a classification for those data elements and instead kind of detailed how the data are classified. So the what the commissioner did approve in terms of the classification that are currently classified is are as either private or non-public. So that means the data subject has access to the data. The entity that has the authority to access the data has access, but the general public does not. So those data elements include license plate numbers, the date, time, and location data on vehicles, pictures of license plates, vehicles, and areas surrounding the vehicles. And the applicant met, there's a standard, they have to both provide kind of a similar data argument, so they have to look at data that are currently classified and explain how their data are similar in nature to get the classification. And the argument the applicant used in this situation was the data that are classified as the personal and vehicle identification data and toll road usage data for individuals that participate in the MinPass program. So that was their similar data argument. They also have to make a compelling need argument as to why the data need a temporary classification. So the compelling need argument they made in this situation was the applicant argued that access to the data may allow a data requester to learn where an individual is living or working. Should a request for ALPR data reveal sufficient location data on vehicles, the applicant argued, criminals could determine travel patterns that expose individuals to unwarranted intrusions. Kind of the same similar arguments were made with regard to the data. So those were the data that were classified. There were a number of other data elements that the applicant argued that should be classified that were disapproved. And those data elements included the date and time of any report run from ALPR data, the name of the person running the report, and the date span of the report, the locations of any ALPR camera, whether mobile or stationary, the device number for each ALPR camera, number of times a vehicle was captured by the ALPR system, and any hit information. And I want to explain a little bit more why those elements were approved, because they already do have the classification under law. But in addition, the applicant didn't make a compelling need argument for any of those data elements, so they didn't meet one of the thresholds of the statutory classification. So the first argument, or the first data element, the date and time of any report run from ALPR data, name of the person running the report, and the date span of the report, those are already public data or private data pursuant to Section 13.15 as to the person running the report. The locations of any ALPR camera, whether mobile or stationary, would already be public or classified as private or non-public security information under Section 13.37, so that's a classification they could already use for those data. The device number for ALPR cameras are public under Section 13.03. The number of times a vehicle was captured by the ALPR system is public or not public law enforcement data under Section 1382. And then any hit information is going to be confidential, active criminal investigative data while the investigation is active, or will resort to public inactive investigation data when the investigation is complete. So that is the overview of the temporary classification, but I'm happy to answer any questions about process or the application itself.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Questions for the testifier? Thank you. And Ms. Christensen, are you going to be sticking around in case folks have questions? Thank
I will.
You.
Yep.
Paul Schnell, Maplewood Chief of Police. Oh, that's right. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood, Minnesota. I want to just say that I understand the committee's concern about the potential for the broad nature of LPR data collection as being potentially overbroad. The proposals brought forward by the Minnesota Chiefs and Sheriffs Associations are practices that in my agency we currently employ. In late October, a homicide occurred in the city of Maplewood. In the days immediately following that murder, there were a host of leads that needed investigative attention and corroboration. As the days led to weeks, ultimately a suspect vehicle had been identified by several witnesses at the scene of that homicide. Realizing and recognizing this fact, our investigators decided that they wanted to access the LPR database to see if our squads had passed that vehicle as they were responding to that call. What we knew was that the vehicle was described as an older white four-door sedan, ultimately, when the initial leads that were received on the night of the homicide dried up, investigators went to the LPR database to look to see if any of the vehicles that they may have passed would ultimately match, allowing them something, some simple small lead perhaps, to begin to try and follow up to see who may have been responsible for this young man's death. It was, in fact, what some may say perhaps an overbroad strategy or a tactic, but in the desire to locate the suspect, such a strategy is important, part of peeling the investigative onion, so to speak. Unfortunately, in that particular case, the LPR data did not lead us to the identification of a suspect. In fact, today we continue to seek that suspect. But what I want to be clear about is that the fact that that data existed speaks to its importance, and certainly this data does have critical investigative importance. Over the past 6 months in our city, we've accessed the LPR database just a handful of times. All of those in cases of serious crime and in matters of what we regard as having public safety importance. I understand clearly this committee's focus and the need for us to have significant levels of public trust. I recognize that in our recent history, there were times when our colleagues perhaps you engaged in over-access of data, specifically DVS. The attention of this committee on those issues was a strong and clear wake-up call for members of law enforcement. The lesson in the end was the need for clear and consistent policy and accountability. Mr. Chair, committee members, we have not accessed our stored LPR data with great frequency at all. We access it, again, only in those cases where it may make a difference. Very few of the personnel in the Maplewood Police Department have access to this LPR database. They simply cannot get into it. The LPRs have proven useful in Ramsey County and in Maplewood specifically. They have a significant value in terms of helping us to recover stolen vehicles from people who these vehicles, especially the older ones that are being stolen, mean a lot to these people in terms of their ability to get to work. Importantly, I feel a high level of confidence that the proposals that have been brought forward to you by Minnesota Chiefs and Sheriff's Associations related to the and the related model policy drafts provide a level of protection of the LPR data that we're all here discussing today. In closing, it might be argued that LPR data is overly broad. Speaking on behalf of those nameless, faceless victims of crime, when the data matters, it could matter significantly. That said, we can, should, and must protect the integrity of LPR data that we possess. Thank you.
Thank
Let's
you.
Stand for any questions.
Thank you, Chief Schnell. Are there questions for Chief Schnell? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Chief Schnell, you had mentioned in your testimony that you had limited access to the data by your department. I'm wondering if this is that data password protected, so you do know who has accessed that data?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is password protected, and again, very few people in our department have access to get into that database at all.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Chief Schnell, that's important to me that it's that it is protected and it's limited access, so and you know who's accessing it, so if somebody's abusing it, it can be dealt with. I'm just wondering what are your policies as far as being able to actually access that data?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our policies do require that they have a lawful purpose that is related to a specific investigation, that there is some level of documentation of that need. In our case, we do have we prioritize kind of those people who do have access, the investigative commander and other command staff, that ultimately allow them to get access to that data. That just happens to be the policy and procedure that we use. We learned clearly that this was a significant issue, having access to this data. You know, our business is a business of public trust. And ultimately, we want to ensure that the data that we have, that we hold, that we think are key and critical investigative tools, are handled with recognized for the significance that those data are.
Ripsa Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, your name again?
Paul Schnell.
Chief Schnell, thank you. The example that you gave of Maplewood and the description of a white older model vehicle, did you just not see when you went back to the license plate reader data, did you see any white vehicles coming and going? And if so, what kind of follow-up did you have on the drivers of those vehicles?
Chief Schnell.
Chair, Representative, we did find numerous. It is truly, as I described, it's peeling the onion. Ultimately, you know, many of those vehicles were just, they were too late model, so they were wiped out. We then started to narrow our focus on a particular type of vehicle based on some experts' kind of information that we had, looking specifically for a Mazda 3 vehicle. Ultimately, we did have some hits of Mazda 3 vehicles, but ultimately those vehicles were far newer than the vehicle that we were seeking in this particular case.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, at any time, did you have to question the owners of those vehicles, or you could just tell that they were newer models, and so did you ever question a person as a possible suspect of one of those cars?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we did not. We were able to vet by using the data. We were able to vet the information and determine that those vehicles were not involved.
Thank you. Any other questions for Chief Schnell? Thank you for your testimony, Chief Schnell.
Thank you,
Deputy Weigel. You.
Chair Lester and committee members. I apologize for the confusion on my not being on the agenda, but my purpose here is to just give a brief overview of what law enforcement is
Please
proposing.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. It's Mark Weigel. I'm an inspector with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office.
Thank you.
So my purpose here is, like I said, to talk about what law enforcement is proposing in relation to this technology. The purpose of it, just a brief overview of that, automatic license plate reader technology may be used to support a wide range of public safety activities, deployment of ALPR, license plate readers, equipment is intended to compare data captured by the ALPR device with existing law enforcement databases such as wanted or stolen vehicles, wanted persons, recorded driver's license violations, and other legitimate law enforcement purposes. ALPR devices enable authorized personnel to recognize and take immediate action against vehicles and persons who are subject to investigative detention or arrest, and the data collected by ALPRs can also provide investigative leads to identify unknown vehicles, to gather data about known suspect vehicles, and to locate potential suspects, witnesses, or victims in the vicinity of a crime scene. ALPR data collection and retention. Data gathered during the operation of an ALPR shall be considered collected for a legitimate law enforcement purpose and may be accessed by law enforcement personnel operating the ALPR system only if there is a legitimate law enforcement purpose for accessing the data. Entry of any data into the system other than data collected by the ALPR system itself must be approved by a supervisor and shall have a legitimate law enforcement purpose. All ALPR data downloaded to the server shall be stored for a specified period of time, and thereafter all ALPR data must be purged unless it has become part of an investigative file. The administration of the ALPR data. Installation and maintenance of ALPR equipment, as well as ALPR data retention and access, shall be managed by the chief of police, sheriff, or head of the law enforcement agency, or their designee, afterwards I'll refer to as administrator. The administrator will assign personnel under his or her command to administer the day-to-day operation of the ALPR equipment and data. Only law enforcement personnel authorized in writing by the administrator may access collected ALPR data, and only for official, legitimate, and documented law enforcement purposes. The administrator shall oversee the ALPR program and is responsible for training and documenting the training of department members on ALPR operation and access, as well as applicable state laws and department policy related to ALPR use and access. Records of access to ALPR data shall include the following: the authorized user who accessed the data, the date and time the data was accessed, and the legitimate law enforcement purpose the data was accessed, including the reasonable factual basis for the access and the associated case number. Law enforcement personnel shall not use or allow others to use the ALPR equipment or database records for any unauthorized purpose. And then lastly, accountability and safeguards. All collected ALPR data will be closely safeguarded and protected by procedural and technological means. Law enforcement personnel will observe the following safeguards regarding access to and use of stored data. All non-law enforcement requests for access to stored ALPR data shall be referred to the responsible authority, administrator, and processed in accordance with applicable law. All ALPR data downloaded to the mobile workstation and server shall be accessible only through a login password protected system capable of documenting all access to information by name, date, and time. And ALPR system audits shall be conducted on a biennial basis. This is a brief overview of what law enforcement is proposing to use this technology.
Thank you for your testimony, Deputy Weigel. Any questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either of the gentlemen, what you've described, I guess my question is, would you oppose the requirement that you get a search warrant before accessing that data in order to have that objective third party make a determination of the kinds of things that you're saying that you're saying you do make that sort of determination? What would be the objection to having a neutral magistrate do that in addition?
Deputy Weigel.
I'm sorry, Chair Lesh, Representative Liebling. The data, first off, the data that is being collected is of vehicles that are in public at this point, and so to go in and look for that and needing a search warrant for that seems that it would add a whole other layer. What we do believe that there should be reason there, and so what we're suggesting would be at a minimum reasonable suspicion. And that would go back to the training aspect of what we're talking about. So anybody that is able to access the system, they would have training in that. They would understand that, and that would be documented in the report by any investigator who is asking to follow up on a lead or a license plate contained in the system. Does that answer your question?
Representative Lavely.
Well, it gives me a window into your thinking, but I don't think it really answers the question. The legislature could require some level of, you know, whether it's probable cause, whether it's reasonable suspicion, whatever, that level could be set by the legislature, and it could be, the job could be given to the neutral magistrate, to the judiciary, to make that determination. And I think what I hear you saying is, well, it isn't necessary because it's all publicly available information. But the fact is it isn't. When it's in that database and it's searchable, you're going through, well, I'm not going to make an argument. I'm just asking you why you, if you would oppose our doing that and why exactly you would oppose it. I'm not sure you really did answer it.
Deputy Weaver.
Chair Lesh and Representative Liebling, again, I don't disagree with you. It is up to the legislature. That's exactly why we're here, and that's part of your job is to provide some guidance, which we welcome the opportunity for standardization here. It just makes it easier for all of us, so we know the playing field and that, and we're all doing the same exact thing. Right now, law enforcement is of the opinion that to go to the level of a search warrant to go after and to be able to just access this data for investigative purposes is more than is probably necessary.
Any other questions for, well, Representative Lieben?
That's okay.
Any other questions for Deputy Weigel? Seeing none, then thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next on the list to testify, Lieutenant Colonel Matt Langer, Minnesota State Patrol. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Langer. I'm the Lieutenant Colonel and Acting Chief of the State Patrol.
Mr. Chair, I'm Drew Evans. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
I think my intention today, or what I believe my intention today, was to just get you up to speed, so to speak, on what the State Patrol is doing in terms of license plate reader technology. We have 12 of these systems. They're all mobile, meaning they're on squad cars that are moving around the state. We don't have any that are assigned to fixed location. And actually, the purpose for the State Patrol having this technology in the beginning was different than that you've heard other law enforcement testify to. Our purpose is traffic safety related, and it's based on the fact that unlicensed drivers are overrepresented when it comes to fatal and serious injury crashes by 2 to 2.2 times. And so our ability to increase the efficiency in locating those unlicensed drivers for us is an angle toward reducing fatal and serious injury crashes, because we can locate those drivers and take enforcement action quicker and more efficiently with LPR than without. So we have 12 systems. They're all mobile, and they are tasked specifically with looking for stolen vehicles and the hits that would be part of the BCA download that's received every day, with the real charge being looking for unlicensed drivers. As a result of our rather unique use of our, or intended use of our systems, our data retention is 48 hours, unless there's an extraordinary reason we don't retain any data longer than 48 hours, again, because of our specific use. That said, I'll entertain any questions, Mr. Chair of the committee.
I have a question, Lieutenant Colonel Langer. Have you ever found that 48-hour retention period to be problematic in following up with investigating crimes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have not, and I would again just reference what you know, being that our use of the data is different than what you've heard my colleagues testify about. We have not had that problem.
Understood. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just curious, how do you find an unlicensed driver by use of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the database receives a download file from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and in that file are the hits for vehicles whose registered owners are revoked, suspended, canceled, don't have a license. So the technology points the trooper toward a vehicle that might have a hit, and then they would have to develop reasonable suspicion to stop that vehicle based on looking at the driver and what they're trained to do. So the license plate reader for us greatly increases their efficiency at locating vehicles whose owners don't have a licensed driver, and then they still have to follow up and make the good case to stop that vehicle.
Any other questions for Lieutenant Colonel Langer? Were you here to testify, Mr. Evans, or you just ride shotgun?
I would just I could testify just briefly on the BCA's role in this, Mr. Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension does not own or operate any license plate readers for our criminal investigative activities. However, as it's been referenced, we do provide the daily file that's downloaded to the different proprietary systems that are owned and operated by law enforcement throughout the state of Minnesota. So that's sent to the agencies twice a day, and as it was referenced, it has the disqualified or the various drivers with driving restrictions, in addition to the FBI hot files, which are wants and warrants that might be associated with that vehicle or for different reasons related to that, as well as some hot files in the state of Minnesota. So that's really our role. Mainly in these systems in particular, we do have an auditing function for many of the various criminal justice databases in the state of Minnesota. However, with a license plate reader, that is not a function we do, because they're proprietary systems owned and operated individually by the different law enforcement throughout the state.
Mr. Evans, you talked about the FBI hot file and data that the FBI shares. Do you in turn share any data with the FBI or federal agencies?
In terms of related to this, we certainly share a number of different criminal justice information with the FBI that's uploaded to the national NCIC system that the FBI owns and operates. So a variety of criminal justice information we do share with the FBI.
What about license plate hit data, metadata, locations, and registered vehicles? Do you share that with the FBI?
We do not share that type of information with the FBI because we do not have that information at the BCA related to license plate readers.
You said that. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Evans? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. Teresa Nelson, Legal Director, ACLU. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Nelson. Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We're a private nonprofit organization whose mission is to protect constitutional rights of all Minnesotans. We've testified before on this issue, so I'll try to be brief. You've already heard about how ALPR systems work, but I think it's also important to note that the storage and collection capabilities of these systems have grown exponentially since they've been introduced. And there is a point, as this technology improves, as the cost goes down, there's a point where we will see ALPR systems deployed on every corner, and the data that they collect will be indistinguishable from tracking every vehicle with a GPS tracker. This will allow the creation of searchable logs for the location information of innocent people, and it also allowed the government to identify people who are engaged in political protests, who are worshiping at particular churches, who is visiting particular doctors. And so we have a serious concern about the implications for this technology on the privacy of innocent people. Given that potential, we believe that this powerful tool should be narrowly tailored to specific law enforcement purposes. You've heard a lot of them today, identifying stolen vehicles, identifying vehicles involved in a crime, or vehicles associated with fugitives or perhaps unlicensed drivers. And these purposes should be set forth in the legislation that you create. We also believe that the legislature should prohibit or limit the retention of this data when it is not associated with a hit for one of those particular purposes. Now, we assume that the primary purpose of ALPR is a legitimate law enforcement purpose to identify those vehicles that are stolen or that are associated with fugitives. and not just simply collect information about innocent people and their movements. A core principle of our society is that we don't hang on to or collect data about innocent people just in case they do something wrong in the future, or just in case they did something wrong that we don't know about until later. The presumption of innocence is a vaunted American value, and we believe that we need to get back to that value, that we presume people to be innocent until proven guilty. You've heard representatives of law enforcement today essentially tell you that this data is simply too important, too useful to throw away. But we also know, and history teaches us, that the temptation to use this data to surveil people for their political or their religious beliefs, that temptation is simply too great, and the potential for abuse is too great. And so the further that we go from this legitimate purpose of this tool, the more critical it is that we have strong protections in place to avoid that temptation. Therefore, if the legislature is going to consider retaining no-hit data on innocent people, we should be talking about days and weeks, not months or years. And access to that data should be limited to situations where law enforcement has a warrant based on probable cause that states with particularity the records that are to be searched and the data to be searched. We're also concerned about sharing data. We want to make sure that any legislation, any protections that are put in place by this body are not subverted by allowing widespread sharing of the data before it has to be purged. Would defeat the purpose, or sharing data without a warrant to allow other people to have access to it when Minnesota law enforcement needs a warrant. And then real quickly, a couple other things that the legislature should consider. We want to make sure that the data subject has access to data if it's a hit. If it's collected on innocent people and retained for any period of time, that data subject should be able to access that and know where they have been tracked. We also, if data is being held or when there's a hit, we want to ensure that data is preserved for the defense. If somebody's facing a criminal prosecution, they should be able to have access to the same information that law enforcement has access to, and it should be a matter of providing a process for the preservation request and disclosure to provide that location data for criminal defendants. And finally, the data that's related to law enforcement's deployment and use of ALPR systems, data that doesn't have any individualized information, location information, but rather how many ALPR systems are in existence, where they're being deployed, who has access to them, that data should all be public because it provides important oversight for the public in order to ensure that law enforcement is not abusing these systems. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Nelson, any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Nelson? Ms. Nelson, and I may have missed this in your testimony, what was the ACLU's position on retention? Did you give a number of days or hours or anything?
We believe in the first instance that no-hit data should not be retained. And if it is retained, we should be talking about days and weeks, not months and years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Nelson.
Thank you.
Rich Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, what's being passed out to you...
Could you introduce yourself?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister.
On the tape. Thank you.
What is being passed out to you is an example of what these things called LPRs do. Well, Mr. Chairman, my testimony is going to be basically on May 17th, 18th, or whenever it was the last time the conference committee met. No resolve. And, Mr. Chairman, as what your intention of the committee is to sort of where are we at right now, and where are we, again, the public, the legislature's at for the year 2015. First of all, that picture that you have here, I want to talk to you a little bit about those things, because these are things that I've been able to get and helps deal with the issue. As you can see, those pictures, they're not just the license plate. thereof outside, you know, a number of feet around the car. You'll see one picture where you see people's. This is the sons or the kids of the person who is doing this. And the technology is improving fast. And since that time, since May, I've come across one of the, again, all these are being pushed by private companies, these LPRs. So Vigilant Solutions, which is one of the big ones, this is a 40-page thing, talks about how they want to intermingle other kinds of public databases, facial recognition, and other kinds of things on top. So which brings the dynamic of not just those pictures that you see, which is based on 4-, 5-year-old, 3-year-old new technologies. Secondly, along in the press, because of all these new things that have happened since May, you're seeing articles. Plans to expand scope of license plate readers, alarm privacy advocates, and open government advocates too. So I'm just trying. Now, the other thing that was learned is that there was a private company and the city of Bloomington had an agreement to where $130,000, approximately, estate money from the Department of Commerce, and about $190,000, approximately, from Homeland Security to provide LPRs to the Mall of America. This is where all the cameras are at. One of the things about it is that there's a lot of information collected, millions and millions of scans, and a relationship between a private company and a city entity, which brings lots of issues. I'm not here to talk. I've done the blog on it. There's a number of articles in it. The issue of what Mall of America gets, or what may get, or they are get, the agreement says that they do get information. Chief Potts publicly said, no, they're not getting any. But on the other side of the coin, I have emails and things like that that say a different perspective. And I talk about that and all that, but that's a decision down in the future. Now, the thing that you were all at in May was a proposal. And the proposal, somewhat what law enforcement just went over with you, is a gist of it. They added some accountability standards. But they also went back in their position. It's now, everything is confidential. They went to a position of 180 days, which at that point at the conference was done 90. Now, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know, I don't expect you, but I can easily give this to you. I've analyzed the House and Senate positions, and some of you, the major differences in between the House and Senate, at least to give you a feel of where things are at. But let me share with you at least where I think some of the issues stand out. Under the current language, or any kind of discussion that I'm seeing, every car scanned could be under perpetual criminal investigation as defined as 1382, with the language that was being discussed in May, and what I see what is being proposed by law enforcement. Always, and this is what California is taking approach to, and there have been a lot of issues on that. The ability to share in a centralized format. Many states and entities are now sending it up to their, like Georgia or California, to their central BCA, or the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, or the Wisconsin, whatever you want to call it. That's one of the things that's happening. This is also that whether it's going to the fusion centers. The proposed language, there was not even discussed about that. Also, when you share to fusion centers and things like that, it can end up going into the feds through the Department of Homeland Security. One of the things that they talk about is databases. Yes, there is one central database, the BCA database, that they talk about. But locals can do their own databases and hook them up to the technology. So, if you're interested to know, you know, all the Occupy Minnesota occupants who own cars and where they're going and organizing, could do that. Or if you want to say at a particular public event, you want to know who may all permit to carry is going to this event. Or like in California, what they did, they had all people who might be gang wannabes, and they had it at the state fair, and what happened, the cops then came and says, we know you're here. One of the other things that's happening since I've been seen and since May is now they're doing what they call electronic roadblocks. So they'll take a stretch of road where a lot of cars can't get off, or a long bridge, let's say Broadway, Plymouth, or Minnetonka, or, I mean, Mendota Bridge. The scam, and they're doing it on warrants, all warrants, simple warrants, you know, the hot list type warrants. So a car gets hit, and so what happens, oh, it rings the bell, and by the time they go, you know, across a bridge or whatever, they're stopped. I mean, these are some of the dynamics that are starting to play. One of the other things is that, and you have to remember, there's only maybe a handful of people that have done a lot of data requests like I have on these issues. So I know a lot about the intimacy of how these things work. And one of the things that they don't have, if you ask with many entities, hey, can you tell me what did you do with the hit? They can't tell me. They can't document what happened to the hit. So did it go into an arrest? Did it go into this? Was it primarily against people of color? You know, so you see trends, patterns. And that has to be addressed in the law. I think the purpose needs to be narrow. Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, particularly in the House, you had a narrow purpose and use of LPRs. I contend that's a good way to start. First Amendment activities, I think, is an important thing. Now, the reasonable suspicion standard, for me personally, I'm not too much into the lockbox. You need a search warrant for this. You need a reasonable suspicion standard. I think that if you have some accountability to make such things as much as public, particularly if you keep the way the temporary classification is, rather than go backwards, which law enforcement is now proposing, in my view, you can do some of the things that some of the states have done. Now, as the conference last year was starting to go, I have my own proposal, Mr. Chairman. Good piece of legislation after reviewing all the states and all that I was going to propose as taking a little bit of this, taking a little bit of that, say yes, keep the data, but we didn't get to that point. So Mr. Chairman and members of the Civil Law Committee, as you go into 2015, lots of questions still need to be answered, and a lot particularly in the detail that law enforcement is proposing to you, and even some new developments that many other law enforcement entities are now doing. And those are the kinds of questions that you should be asking Minnesota law enforcement entities. Are they setting it here? Are they doing it there? If they're not, fine, then let's have a law that says that we're not going to do it, because we're learning what's happening in all the other public agencies. And the last comment, Mr. Chairman, as you and all folks do this in 2015, I think it's just important to have a little flow chart. What in the long run, particularly with law enforcement entities, when they say it's this, it's that, or whatever, what eventually becomes public? So you can see for yourselves, and then we, the public, can see and have accountability and scrutiny as we go into this new technology. Because whatever comes out as a policy here will determine future things when some of the new stuff starts coming down the line. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I wish to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Ealing, you want to be heard on this too? Okay. We are trying to wrap up. We're moving on 2 hours here, so if you can present your testimony briefly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. We've testified on this before. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. The proposition that we're trying to make over the last couple sessions in regard to LPR, now in regard to body cams, is this idea that data collection by the government needs to be tailored to a narrow purpose. In the LPR context, you can certainly have a public safety benefit from gathering the data, but there's a lot of indiscriminately collected data that is gathered up by these things, as other testifiers have alluded to. And we supported the last House iteration of this bill that had a very, very narrow retention timeline, and that data was destroyed if it was non-hit data. So we support that idea. But the main point I want to make right now, and I'll make it quickly, is that we feel that this is a critical time in the legislature for these kinds of issues. The technology that is being employed by law enforcement is increasingly gathering this kind of indiscriminate data on lots and lots of people. And there's a history in the United States in our jurisprudence stretching through the Fourth Amendment
where there's specificity in warrants. Up until the 1970s, the Attorney General Levi guidelines that tried to rein in the FBI and make sure that they were collecting data, you know, under criminal predicate standard, and not just opening up indiscriminate investigations on people. If we start to go down the path, if we codify in law in Minnesota that we can start to aggregate and collect and maintain a lot of this indiscriminate data, it's really fundamentally changing the nature of our society. And I think that's the point that people need to bear in mind as we go forward on this. So thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Ealing. Having reached the end of discussion on LPR, any commentary from members of the committee? So I will say this, members, just to give you some background on how this began. A data practices request was made by the Star Tribune in the summer of 2012 for 2 million images. 2 million license plate images collected by the City of Minneapolis LPR units by their police department during the month of June 2012. That information, because it had not previously been classified by this body, was all released to the Star Tribune, and it was determined that less than 1% of it was used for criminal charges, but the remaining 99.2% was of innocent people. And the City of Minneapolis immediately moved for a temporary classification of that data. They received it. We are now laboring under that temporary classification, which expires this coming summer. We've gone since through two legislative sessions of no action on LPR, so the status quo remains essentially that law enforcement or whatever agency you want to talk about can essentially do whatever they want with license plate reader data. You've heard the uses of it being that it's really useful. I'm sure I could probably put words in all your mouths as agreeing with that, that it is, of course, incredibly useful data. The question for this committee, moving into next legislative session, is to decide how we want to classify that, whether there should be any provision for collection of images that can track the movements of innocent people. I'm reminded of the old Family Circus cartoons where they got the little kid going through the neighborhood and there's the dotted line at the sandbox, and every little point you can get a good picture of what someone's day has been just by knowing where they've gone. And if this is on innocent people, we need to make sure that we have a position on that. So I wanted to make sure we're tracking that the chair next legislative session, Peggy Scott, can hit the ground running on this, because if we fail to do our jobs this next legislative session on this, then all of that data becomes public again. So without any other commentary from the committee, we'll move on to item four, which is my presentation. I will, with the committee's indulgence, just present it from the chair, because it's just for the purposes of topic of discussion. I did present this morning to, do we have printout handouts?
Yes.
Okay, the handouts are in your packets. It is my proposal for the Legislative Commission on Intelligence and Technology. And members, this relates somewhat to LPR, but also to the Kingfish and Stingray debate that we had in the legislature last session. As many of you on the committee know, it became extraordinarily difficult to get testimony from the policymakers of agencies on whether they use it, whether they intend to use it. We sent out quite a few letters on two different occasions throughout the summer of 2013, once in June and again, I think, in they were spaced about 6 months apart, and there was very limited response. We did receive responses from small departments who didn't have the budget for it and didn't use it, but from obviously the major departments in the metro area, there was no response. So we were not able to make decent decisions about how the technology and the data was used, and it, in my opinion, the opinion of many people on the committee, it tied our hands. And the response that I received from several law enforcement officials is that there's no incentive for us to come to the legislature and talk about this. And it quickly became apparent to me that they were telling the truth. And that caused me great concern. Because if that's the case, the legislature has an oversight function, and I'll go into that in my presentation. So, first of all, this proposal is a bill. It was the A5 amendment to Representative Holberg's Data Practices Commission that I attempted to amend on the floor. I couldn't get it on the floor at that time. But it does clearly delineate the legislature's fundamental oversight function in ascertaining and determining the use of intelligence and technology. What this does not do, this bill does not change any data set classifications. The two things we need to consider is, one, whether the legislature is getting the information it needs to make policy decisions, and number two, is the legislature getting this information in a timely manner? And the what we've looked at today suggests to me that the answer to both, well, the answer to the first question is no, and the answer to the second question is also no. Finally, I would submit to you on this that in considering whether this is a worthwhile endeavor, that in reality, you should consider only your own conscience in determining whether you are fulfilling your constitutional obligation of legislative oversight. Because the Constitution makes clear that it is the legislative branch that oversees the executive branch. Police powers are inherent under the executive branch. If we cannot make a determination of how policing powers are affected, then we have failed in our roles of legislative oversight. So I'd submit to you that the opinions of privacy advocates, open government advocates, law enforcement, or private sector business should be irrelevant in your decision as to whether you're fulfilling your constitutional role. I have three quotes here, one from John Stuart Mill: the proper office of a representative assembly is to watch and control the government. Woodrow Wilson said, quite as important as legislation is vigilant oversight of administration. And finally, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, stated in Federalist Number 51 that he sought to subordinate the distributions of power, where the constant aim is to divide and arrange the several offices in such a manner that each may be a check on the other. And this, members of the committee, is the foundation of our system of checks and balances, which we are guaranteed. Each state is guaranteed a Republican form of government, inherent in which is the checks and balances. So why is this needed? Number one, until data is collected by the government, until that data is identified, it is not protected or classified under Chapter 13. By default, like LPR data, it is public and can be obtained by anyone and used or abused by those in control of it. Second, the rapid pace of data collection and advancing technology is creating new data sets faster than we can classify them. Third, vast amounts of data is collected that can enhance or restrict the lives of Minnesotans. Furthermore, this is our fundamental oversight function. Law enforcement agencies, as I stated, do not have incentive to volunteer information on their operations to the legislature. It just does not exist. They have multiple agreements with federal offices, FBI, postal inspectors, Secret Service, however those go, and it really, based upon those agreements and how they do their job, it does not make a whole lot of sense for them to come to the legislature and talk in an open meeting about the basis for how they do their policing and their information sharing arrangement. That's a really, really a problem for us. It may be true, and they may be doing their jobs, and I don't can't even say if they're making the right decision in doing that or not, but I can say that we're failing in our duty if we don't get that information. And finally, the legislative subpoena power is ineffective. As we saw this past year with respect to trying to get information on Kingfish and Stingray, it was ineffective because of the two-thirds required vote in committee to have the subpoena, and furthermore, because even if we have the two-thirds votes, many of these law enforcement officials just aren't going to come, whether or not they're in contempt of the legislature. It is still not enough of an incentive for them. Therefore, I came up with this proposal to have what mirrored on the federal level the House and Senate Intelligence Committees that meet and are not subject to open public scrutiny but can consider this information in a closed meeting and make certain determinations based upon that information and perform our fundamental oversight function. These technologies that the legislature has become aware of recently include kingfish, stingray, license plate readers, body cameras, drone surveillance, and facial recognition software, which is in the works. Each of these technologies, over the course of the past few years, we have discovered, not because folks have come up here to tell us, but because we found them found out about them in the newspaper, or there was some giant data breach, or there were things going on that we found out by third party. I submit that our oversight function does not permit us to just discover this by happenstance and then regulate it after the fact. The proposal establishes an investigative and oversight commission similar to the intelligence committees in Congress. It consists of 3 senators and 3 representatives serving 4 years with 1 member of the minority party from each. Each member must take an oath not to disclose the information that is discussed in the commission. The commission may determine that a meeting is not open to the public. The commission may require law enforcement to disclose not public data. Disclosure of data outside of the commission meeting is ground for an ethics complaint and creates liability under Minnesota Statute 1308 by creating a cause of action and an action to compel compliance. I submit that I think that is too weak of a consequence for discussing secret information, but I leave that up to members of the legislature to decide. Finally, members of the commission may issue subpoenas to compel testimony and the production of records. Finally, I would just note the importance of oversight. The history we are following on the tails of about 40 years ago when this occurred in Congress on Capitol Hill, where there was some disquiet and discomfort with the Intelligence Committee about certain international incidents which had occurred, and Congress had claimed that this was due to lack of proper oversight by those agencies, and they knew full well that despite all of Congress's efforts, they were not going to get this classified information in an open hearing, whether they issued subpoenas or not. So they created the intelligence committees. The unique pace and scale of the data collection and technology must be balanced with these privacy interests and the Data Practices Act in successfully monitoring what these government agencies collect and how they collect it. So that's it. I would invite members of the committee to comment on it if they would like, but mostly I am presenting this for future digestion. If someone can come up with a better plan to get a handle on this technology and not consistently react to it, I am absolutely all ears. I would note in closing that the purpose of the criminal justice system is to address past wrongs and correct them by either a civil judgment or a criminal conviction. The purpose of the legislative branch is to ascertain what are growing problems and establish forward-looking policy. As it stands right now, the legislature is in an unenviable position of having to react, similar to the criminal justice system, by policy, and I think that is bad. It is bad for Minnesota, and it's bad for a Republican form of government. So there you have it. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I talked a little bit about this proposal that you had last at the end of the session this year. One thing that law enforcement has working against them is shows like NCIS, CSI, showing all this technology. Unfortunately, the perpetrators in a lot of instances are also watching this and seeing the information. They're looking for the information as to how law enforcement agencies conduct their investigations. I believe that's one reason why they're real hesitant about giving up the information, because they do not want the people who are committing the crimes to know how they solve those crimes. A committee like this would give us the oversight and give us the ability to deal with possible situations that might arise from the technology that as it is expanding and in leaps and bounds. What do they say? Every time technology expands, it expands in half the time. And we're getting where the computers and the cell phones that we have with us when they hit the stores are already outdated. But we need to do something to be able to have the oversight. And I believe that we should be doing it open, but in this particular situation, is being involved in law enforcement and working on these, on some of the crimes that I've had to work on, I think is something we do have to look at doing.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Any other commentary from members of the committee? Okay. I'm not inviting public to comment on this. Mr. Neumeister, thank you, though. Seeing none, then thank you all for serving on the committee. I do appreciate it. I look forward to serving with you next session. Committee is adjourned.